Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network, and I've got a simple question for you. If your kids don't show up for school, can they ever succeed? And on top of that, why should the kids show up when they know that no matter how bad their grades are, no matter what they know how to do or not do, like reading and writing and math, at least in the state of Oregon, they're going to get a diploma guaranteed because the Democrats have made it state law that you cannot be denied a high school diploma just because you can't read, write, or add numbers up. Now, I'm going to give you some numbers that are going to just blow your mind when it comes to school attendance and absenteeism and how the rest of the United States is doing and how the states of the Pacific Northwest, the ones served by the Radio Northwest Network, how Oregon, Washington, and Idaho are doing. And there are some dramatic differences that tell the story. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest, and you're invited to join in at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer and you've got the guts, come on the show. Call the show and you'll go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X today, that's the daily poll that we put up, used to be on Twitter, and now it's on X. But the poll question is right to the point. Should Americans pay the housing costs for asylum seekers who are staying here in the Pacific Northwest and who are very, very likely to be denied asylum by the courts when their cases finally come up? I was spurred to do this when I saw a story, I think it was on Como News. A group of 240 refugees is on the brink of losing housing in the city of Kent. And the headline of the story says they've been trying to raise enough money to stay in their hotel until they can find stable shelter. Now, up till now, the taxpayers have been paying their way. I think that's probably a very nice thing to do, although I'll bet they didn't ask the voters of their communities about it. One refugee named Adriana, who's been living at the Quality Inn in Kent for weeks, said through an interpreter that the group of 240 Venezuelan refugees might look to stay in a park in Seattle if they have to check out today because of lack of funding. They said Seattle provided enough funding for a month the first time, but declined the second request, during which another group disrupted the council proceedings. So I'd ask you this. What obligation do the taxpayers have in states like Oregon and Washington, where we're told we don't have enough schools, we don't have enough teachers, we don't have enough cops, we don't have enough prosecutors, we don't have enough defense attorneys? We're short of just about everything, but we're paying the way for a bunch of refugees who, based on the numbers, are almost guaranteed to be denied asylum, which means they're just freeloaders. And you say, but we have to pay for their housing. No, they could go out and do something. Well, no, they can't, because in most cases, they don't have the right to work, which means Joe Biden is brought into America, not as big as of a problem here in the Pacific Northwest as, say, New York or Chicago or Washington, D.C., but a big problem all the same. And we're talking about millions and millions of dollars that are going to have to be spent to support people who in almost all likelihood are going to be told by the judge, you don't qualify for asylum and now you must leave. So, should Americans pay the housing costs for asylum seekers virtually guaranteed to be denied asylum at the end of the process? You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and on our website at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. And before I go back to talking about school absenteeism, I've got to mention this. The Republicans on Capitol Hill back in Washington, D.C. They know exactly how to drive the liberals crazy. Do you know what they just did about 3 hours ago? They introduced a very simple bill. I mean, after all, Congress gets involved in naming post offices and other significant public infrastructure. Can you imagine this? They have now proposed, and I love the idea. I don't think it has a snowball's chance, but they have proposed the idea that the international airport in the D.C. area, known as Dulles International, is named after John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State for Eisenhower. They have proposed to rename it Donald John Trump International Airport. Now, can you imagine how much the liberals have their heads spinning when that kind of proposal is made? I mean, they're just going crazy about this. They already know that Joe Biden's going to lose the presidential election. They know that Robert F. Kennedy's probably going to take it away from him. And now they're proposing to rename a major airport after Donald John Trump, the same way that D.C. International is named after Ronald Wilson Reagan. It's absolutely driving them crazy. In any case, glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Might even have a naysayer soon. But I want to tell you this first. If you don't show up for school, there is no way you can succeed at school, except that Oregon and to some extent Washington have made it possible to succeed by simply not showing up, not getting grades, not learning how to read, write, or count, but you still get a diploma. In Oregon, they made that state law. Consider what happened, and of course, the pandemic had an effect on this. The usual year-to-year absenteeism rate nationwide is about 15%. In other words, folks, you are paying, in most parts of America, about $250,000 will buy 12 years in K through 12 school. It's almost $20,000 a year, and that's what it costs. So you're providing that, and 15% of the time, the kids simply don't show up. Now, that's the percentage of kids who miss at least 10% of a school year. It was 15% in 2018 before the pandemic. It went all the way to 28% in 2022. But in most of the states, it is now going back down again. It is falling in 33 out of 39 states that offered up data. The other 11 states apparently didn't report. And the absenteeism rates among different groups of kids, 16% among Asian students, 24% of white students, 36% of Hispanic students, and 39% of black students miss at least 10% of every school year. Except Oregon is absolutely terrible. I mean, at 38%, that means Oregon's absenteeism rate, even with the increase nationwide, is about 50% higher than the national rate. Washington State, not much better. It went from a 15% absenteeism rate before the pandemic to about 30%. One-third of the kids not showing up for at least 10% of the school year that you are paying literally billions of dollars for. And if you say, well, that's just the way it works, no, not necessarily. Idaho, before the pandemic, had a chronic absenteeism rate of 3%. So is it achievable? Absolutely. In fact, it was 3 in 18, 3 in 19, 8% in 2019, 16% in 2020. But now it's back down to 18%. It's going back down. Meanwhile, Oregon, 38%, well over a third of the kids, don't show up more than 10% of the time. It is a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Northwest Nonsense coming up next.
Plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. But when I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
I never, ever get tired of calling out the lies of government agencies like the Oregon Health Authority, and I will name names. 3 weeks ago, OHA Director of Public Health, Kara Biddlecom, sent an email to her staff blaming the death of an Oklahoma teenager on anti-transgender violence. Joe Biden joined the chorus, so did Nancy Pelosi. It fits their progressive political agenda, but unfortunately for them, it is a lie. Now we know more about it. Dagny Benedict called Next Benedict by the mainstream media, but it was actually a young lady named Dagny Benedict did not die from a beating in a school bathroom, as Biddlecom had claimed. She died from suicide. And here are a couple of more facts about a girl who sometimes told people she was non-binary. Facts that might help explain why she didn't want any gender, but I will warn you that it is ugly. Her father anally raped her at age 9 5 years ago. He pleaded guilty to that crime, and he got 5 years. He walked out of prison on January 25th of this year. 2 weeks later, his daughter Dagny got into a fight at school, and one day later, she took her own life. She was only 16. I can connect those dots. Can we demand that liberal politicians stop abusing her death and every other death like it to push their trans agenda? Maybe we just make the death penalty available for child rapists the way Florida did 1 year ago. Put that on the ballot and see what the voters have to say about it. I'll get to your calls in a moment. In fact, I'm curious about the naysayer from Seattle. Let me tell you a couple of other things, too, though. I got this email from John, and he wrote in, Lars was just listening to the segment yesterday about Joe Biden declaring Easter Trans Day, and the naysayer caller that went to an accepting church, preach them into hell. When attempting to have a discussion about this, I'll ask if they're familiar with anorexia. Most people know what that is. My question is, if your child had anorexia, because she believes she was too fat, let's say, would you be supportive of their belief and help them starve themselves to death? That seldom makes the point, but it's the best I can do. I enjoy the show, but the naysayers drive me nuts. Signed, John. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give the Daily Grill, we're going to do a long-distance grill today, to Presiding Magistrate Judge Humberto Acosta down in Texas, a federal judge who ruled on Easter Sunday that some of the illegal alien border crossers accused of storming the National Guard that were guarding the Lone State border should be released with no bail whatsoever. Despite the violent nature of the rioters, Judge Acosta granted most of them personal recognizance, meaning all they had to do was sign a piece of paper promising they would appear in court instead of posting monetary bail. Now, I there aren't a lot of funny things about any of this, but imagine this. A federal judge, that's a lifetime job with a big fat paycheck. And a federal judge is asking somebody who just illegally came into the United States, who just illegally assaulted Texas National Guard, will you sign a piece of paper promising to show up for your court date? Now, what do you think is the likelihood of that? Today's best email, but you can always send more. This one came in with a request to leave the signature off. Lars, the non-governmental organizations are killing us. I applied for a mobile home to buy under a federal program for Alameda fire refugees implemented by Access. They ordered hundreds of them built in Idaho, but they wouldn't meet the Oregon regulations. Who paid for them all? Taxpayers. We waited a year to find out we weren't getting anything. Access wouldn't even tell me the cost, a sliding scale. So if you're indigent, you pay nothing. They said I was the only person who even asked about the cost. A bunch of woke social workers with their preferred pronouns on all correspondence, giving out each other's phone numbers and never doing anything for the fire victims as we wait year after year after year. Now, contrast that with the idea that asylum seekers who were not invited to this country and likely will not be judged to be worthy of asylum are getting free housing from the taxpayers, but people who were burned out by a fire in the Northwest, They get nothing after several years? Somebody tell me that makes sense. On that note, let's go to the first naysayer of the day. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. You know that we love naysayers on this show. Thanks for listening on KVI in Seattle. What do you and I disagree about today?
Well, you're a capitalist. I'm a socialist. Now, I will, mind you, I wanted to point out parenthetically that I talk about economics a lot on the radio. Because in our greedy, selfish land, that's one of the big things that we need to talk about, because it affects so many other areas, including the environment, which is being destroyed, also in pursuit of never-ending growth rates.
That's about six topics all at once. So what do we disagree about? I think that capitalist countries have a better record of taking care of the environment than socialist countries. Do you think they care in Venezuela, a socialist country, whether they ruin the environment as they pump oil to keep the elites rich in Venezuela while the poor stay poor? Or do you really think that socialist countries do a better job of taking care of the environment, since you brought it up?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know that for sure. I'd have to look it up myself to be, but I also know that
wrong, but
Venezuela, let me just say something. Venezuela has 70% a capitalist economy and 30%, at least that's the last time I checked.
No, the oil, all of the oil wealth of that country is in the hands of the government
down there.
Do you understand, Jim, when you say
the whole country is socialist, meaning it?
Yeah, Venezuela is a notoriously socialist country, and it used to be a very wealthy capitalist country. They went socialist, and now they're one of the poorest countries on the planet.
That's why Chavez got in, because the people were so happy that they decided to change in midstream, even though it was doing good for them. So we'll disagree on that one, but I'd like to just mention
a bunch of socialists took over and wrecked the whole thing. That's what you want to do in America? Why?
Well, I think our capitalist system is ruining the ecology and the economy.
Can you tell me an example of it ruining the ecology? I want to know what you think. Can you tell me what capitalism does to wreck the environment?
Well, it when it's deregulated, especially, it overplows the land.
Can you name a part of our capitalist economy that is deregulated? It's all regulated.
The whole thing, there's mining.
I got a question for you, Jim. Who planted more trees? Who planted more trees last year, you or Weyerhaeuser?
Yeah, but how many did they cut down?
They cut down fewer than they planted. How many trees did you plant last year, Jim? Since you care so much about the environment, Jim, tell us how many trees you planted last year.
Where I live, I can't plant trees.
Tell me something you've done that was good for the environment.
I don't drive a car, but, the cars are... Now, it was 111 degrees up here a couple years ago. Now, does that bother you at all?
Did you run your air conditioner?
I don't have an air conditioner.
Okay. So tell me something good you did for the environment, Jim. The problem is you didn't do anything, and Weyerhaeuser's done plenty. Back in a moment.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland. Lars wants a job for any American who wants one, with one exception.
It's time to tell Crooked Joe Biden, you're fired.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Loved starting out the day with an naysayer just now. And Dave Honeycutt is a great friend of the show. He's president of the Oregon Property Owners Association, and I want to talk to him about farmland. Hey, Dave, welcome back.
How you doing, Lars?
I'm doing well, except I get tired of people saying, why, we have a law that protects the right to farm in Oregon. And, of course, you have urban growth boundaries that, in theory, protect land so that farms can exist. But is Oregon protecting farmers or farmland?
Well, we've done a really good job for the last 50 years, Lars, of essentially putting a straitjacket on rural Oregon and calling it protecting farmland. But we've done a really bad job of actually helping farmers, those people that we expect to farm that land that we're keeping off limits to anything else.
I mean, I have read recently about the fact that the state has always had these laws on the books, but now they're running around saying, oh, you're a small farmer. Oh, you need a permit on that well. And then they lay down the requirements, and in some cases, the farmer gets cut off from water. Is that what you're hearing as well?
I am, and, you know, one of the things I think probably, Lars, the most, I guess, outrageous thing that we do for our farmers in this state is that not only do we tell them that they have to farm, but then we make it hard for them to do other, you know, to have other activities on the farm that'll actually allow them to make some money so that they can continue to farm. And that's the whole point. If we protect the land, but we don't let the farmer make any money, then we're not really protecting anything. We're not saving farmland, and we're hurting farmers.
Yeah, and in fact, a few years ago, maybe even 20 years ago, Dave, but I think the laws are the same. I remember talking to this older couple on the air, and they'd gone out and bought 5 acres. And you say, well, what can you farm on 5 acres and make money other than pot or maybe opium poppies? And they said, no, we grow blueberries. I said, well, you can grow a lot of blueberries on 5 acres. And they were making a living. But the wife who did the books for the man's farm, said, well, maybe I'll start doing taxes for other people. And so she decided to start doing taxes from her, you know, basically her kitchen table. And she was, you know, filling out people's taxes every year. It's almost tax time now. And then the state of Oregon came along and said, you can't do that business. You've got to go into town, into a commercially zoned area, and rent yourself an office and do your taxes at a table there instead of a table in your kitchen. So there's an example where the farmer's wife, who also wanted to make blueberry muffins and sell them, and she was told, you can't make blueberry muffins or blueberry bread or blueberry jam or anything else and sell it at the blueberry farm. That's a commercial activity. You have to do that somewhere else. Are those good examples of what the state does to make it hard to make a living on a farm?
They are, Lars, and you make two really good points that I think people, you know, don't really understand about farming in Oregon. Oregon is really a state of small farms. 67% of our of Oregon farms are less than 50 acres in size, and 74% of all of our farmers, basically three quarters of them, gross less than $25,000 a year on farming. And so we are a small farm state, which is part of the reason why only about 40% of the farmers identify farming as their primary occupation. Your wife doing the tax work is a prime example of that. And so we have to come to grips, our legislative folks have to come to grips with the fact that Oregon is a small farm state, and we need, rather than discourage farmers from, you know, from doing taxes in the house or having a pumpkin patch or a farm stand or a farm-to-table dinner or, you know, school tours or things like that. We need to encourage our farmers to do that so that they can make enough money that they can keep the land, whether it's 5 acres or 40 acres, in ag production. It's a win-win for everybody.
I think it is, too. And when they tell me you can't build housing on that, it's got to be safe for farming. Dave, one of the problems, we always hear about how housing affordability is, and it's gone to hell under Joe Biden. I mean, it went from where you had to make $60,000 a year 3 years ago to where you have to make over $100,000 a year across America to buy a house. And you say, okay, that's affordability there. Dave, every time I've run the numbers on farming, unless you inherit the land or you win the lottery or you've got a high-dollar city job like lawyer or doctor, nobody can afford to farm, can they?
Well, and you raise a couple of other good points. We've had what we call the $80,000 rule in place for almost 20 years, actually for over 20 years, Lars. And that rule requires a farmer to make $80,000 in farm income for 2 years in a row before they can build a farmhouse on their farm. And so what we expect is young people to go out there and buy 80 acres because we We can't have, you know, we can't create farms any smaller than 80 acres now. So they have to go out and buy 80 acres, and they have to rent a place in town, and then they have to go out and farm, and they have to make at least $80,000 for 2 years in a row. And then we might let them build a farmhouse that they can live in on the farm, which is precisely one of the reasons why the average age of Oregon farmer just continues to rise. We make it really hard for young people to get into the industry, and it's a shame.
I mean, because the numbers don't pencil. I remember doing it with grass seed farmers a few years ago, and I said, well, you know, how many acres do I need to be a grass seed farmer? I was just curious. And he said, about 100. I said, what's that cost, you know, in the Willamette Valley? And he said, about $10,000 an acre. I said, so I need to buy 1 million acres of land. And then, you know, can I make a living on that and pay the mortgage? Because the mortgage on $1 million is probably $50,000-$60,000 a year alone. And they said, well, you can either pay yourself or pay the mortgage, but you're not going to do both off 100 acres of grass seed land. And I said, isn't grass seed one of the most, you know, lucrative kinds of farming there is? And they said, yeah, that's why there's so much of it. Oregon supplies almost all the grass seed for America, and I think about 30% of the grass seed for the entire planet. And I said, so you're telling me that nobody could actually get into this business and make it pencil out unless they have a big pile of money already, right?
Well, exactly. And it's really why we just need to come to grips with the fact that we're primarily a small farm state. We ought to encourage our small farmers. We ought to make it easier, or not completely easy, but easier for young people that want to get into farming to get into farming. And then once they get into farming, we need to allow them to go out and do some direct, really, it's direct marketing, Lars, is what they need to be able to do. They need to get people from Portland to drive out on a Saturday afternoon in October to bring their kids and grandkids and pick a pumpkin and ride the train and go through the corn maze and do all of those things that people like. Not only does it allow the farmer to make some money, but it makes them a direct connection with people in town who think their food comes from the grocery store.
Well, and in fact, they also have all these other limitations. Yes, you can have the pumpkin patch. Oh, you want to sell hot chocolate? Not allowed. Not a farm activity. You want to sell people apple cider? Well, I guess if you grew the apples there, but otherwise it's a commercial activity. It's almost like a bunch of elites got together and said, we really like the view of all the farmland, and we like all the green, and we want people to farm, but we're not going to make it possible for them to earn a living at it, but we're going to keep them from selling their land for anything else, so we'll force them to be farmers, and they end up being the feudal serfs of all the people who live in the big cities. Dave Honeycutt runs the Oregon Property Owners Association. Dave, thanks the primer on that, and I appreciate the time. I'll be glad to get to your phone calls in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote on our poll on X. Should the Seattle taxpayers or the taxpayers of Washington State be paying the housing costs for asylum seekers who are almost certain to be denied asylum while they stay in hotels in places like the city of...
Go to the head of the line at the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to give you some comparisons in a moment about the key bridge that fell down in Baltimore having been hit by a ship, and the interstate bridge replacement, and the comparisons will absolutely make you seethe with anger at how much it's going to cost, or they say it's going to cost, to replace the Interstate 5 bridge over the Columbia River between Oregon and Washington, and how much the key bridge is going to be replaced for. Let me give you a hint. It's a whole lot less. But I wanted to go back to naysayer Jim in Seattle. Jim, I'm really curious. You say you're in favor of socialism. Can you tell me what do you do for a living right now?
I'm disabled and getting close to a retirement. How's that
sound? How old are you?
I prefer not to give my precise age.
Give me a range. Are you older than 40?
Well, I'm getting close to retirement, so I'll just...
No, I'm going to ask you this. Are you older than 40 or younger than 40?
Okay, I'll play the game with you. Older than 40.
Okay, and you're getting ready to retire from what profession?
Well, I never really had a profession, if you want to call it. I worked for 11 years, and then things went bad, and I'm on disability. So,
what is your disability?
It's a mental disability.
You don't want to work? Is that? I mean,
I've worked harder than you'll ever work. I'm sure.
Tell me this. I work 12 hours a day. I don't feel the need to explain what I do. But tell me this.
You have a white collar job.
11.
And I don't believe in hard work either, because I know it's very difficult for some people. Are you gonna how are you gonna help the meat packers and the farmhands and stevedores? Why did the labor movement
difficulty
to get us down to an 8-hour work day? Because they said, oh no, we want to work for low, cheap slave wage labor. It's so much fun, and we won't
You've been
work
reading
for a
10-hour
day
Karl
than an
8-hour
day.
Lately,
get killed
Jim.
In the process. So
Jim,
that's my part.
Why is most people are proud to say what they do for a living? What did you do for 11 years that allows you to retire when you're not even 60?
Well, I'm not retired, by the way. I paid into the system when I worked. That's fair.
For 11 years, the bare minimum to qualify for Social Security.
That's right. And so if your house burns down after you've had insurance for 3 years, you still collect a lot more than you paid in, right?
That's the way it goes. Insurance is different.
And I didn't try to become disabled. I worked my ass off. So
and your disability is mental.
I'm sure of that.
There is
Unless
no job
better than me.
Jim, there is no job you could do, because you're talking to me on the phone right now, and there are lots of jobs that involve just talking on the phone. So how is it that
but
you're actually disabled?
Doing.
I know, but why don't you do
Can I say something for once?
Please.
I wanted to recommend for people Michael Parenti, P-A-R-E-N-T-I, The Myth of Capitalism. So that's what I spend a lot of my time doing, and I don't have always the energy or the wherewithal, and the difficulties mount. So go to your computer. He's a great man.
Your difficulty is capitalism that's paying your rent right now.
No, capitalism isn't paying
your
rent. I pay into the system, and I get a check every month for not much to live on.
In other words, you get to take money from all the other capitalists who are still paying into the system. You get to leech off the system. If you're proud of that, fine. No wonder you love the idea of socialism, because you want a check from the government for doing nothing. Let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. I know Ron's a hardworking guy. What's on your mind?
Man, after just hearing that guy, I've been working since 46 years, since I was 11 years old. My foster father in California said there's no free lunch. You got to put the work, the honor, and the character. But getting back to the main point,
yeah,
the housing situation in Washington and Oregon and California, this is designed, in my opinion, Lars. I did research just a few minutes ago. The 7 counties on the Bay Area, they've taken away the right in Oregon since 2018 to have housing. You want to know what a housing shortage? They want to build these tall gulags. But they're going to give the money away to the illegal invaders that's bringing drugs. They're doing cheap work, and I have no problem with. But the point is this. It's affecting people like myself. The rents jumped up on me twice.
Yep.
The rent jumped up on my friend who's a single father who works for a subsidiary of a aircraft company for $24 an hour. You would think that's good money. But
and
when you're raising a single
child, think bringing 10 million additional people into the country and putting them effectively on the dole for starters and maybe for the long term is going to make our housing situation better or worse?
It's going to make it 10 times worse. And when you go through and you restrict the farmers and the ranchers on the sustainability plans that they want, and as a beekeeper that I watched my adopted father with 41 years start from nothing to become, and with the policies of the green energy, it kills businesses. It kills them with the increase of the CAT tax. And on top of that, you're going to raise the utility rates and everything else. These combinations, along with the illegal invaders that's coming to our country, and we're prioritizing segregationally legal aliens over Americans.
Absolutely right. Ron, thanks for the call. Jeremy, what's on your mind?
Hey, I got a question for you.
Sure.
I've been trying to get like a farm deferral because I live outside of city limits in Oregon City. I have about 3/4 of an acre. And every tax person, I went to H&R Block and then a private company there. And they're still saying that I can't. I mean, I have goats, chickens, quails, rabbits, and I'm just starting up with bees. And they just keep on shooting me down, and I'm just trying to do it as a side gig. Because
you're talking about farm deferral, meaning some of your land, not your house, but the rest of your land would have a lower tax rate as a farm, right?
Yep, correct.
And did you hear what Dave Honeycutt said? They have a rule that says if you want to call yourself a farmer in Oregon, you've got to show $80,000 in gross sales of your farm's output for 2 years, 80 grand a year for 2 years, or you can't be a farmer. Now, that's easy for somebody with a lot of money to do, not so easy for an actual farmer to do. Jeremy, thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We'll do that a bit later, but first, I want to put this question to Senator John Braun, who's in the Washington State Legislature, whether or not the Democrats in Washington State are trying to use the census and redrawn legislative maps to actually boot Republicans out of the seats they currently hold so the Democrats can have an advantage in Olympia. Senator Braun, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me on, and you're absolutely right. We have a long-heralded redistricting process. It's a bipartisan process put in place by Republicans and Democrats back in the 80s, as long held as one of the best in the country, if not the best in the country. And this year, over the last couple years, since redistricting occurred after the last census, the Democrats have undermined that process and used the courts now to cause a major change, a big change in redistricting in the middle of the cycle through the federal court system using the Voting Rights Act. It's really a travesty of justice, and it does a bunch of things to Republican legislatures, not only on the east side of the state where the problem is purported to exist, but also on the west side of the state.
Well, just so people understand what the courts have thrown out, you described it as a bipartisan process. You've got a commission, correct?
Yes.
And it's made up of two Democrats and two Republicans, and they draw the maps. Now, there's a little bit of push and shove because either side wants to get their side the advantage. But I've talked to a member of the commission on the air, and he describes the process as, well, if you know you're going to sit down at the table with a couple of Democrats, you're going to have to come in with a reasonable-sounding proposal for redrawing the maps based on the new census so that all the legislative districts have roughly the same amount of people in them. You walk in and say, here are the things we've done. We've tried to draw the maps so that we follow geographic boundaries. You don't put somebody on one side, on the north side of Puget Sound, and, you know, the legislative district continues on the south side. You try not to zip over mountains, although Oregon has done that as well, where they have legislative districts that go to both sides of the Cascade Mountains. You try not to jump rivers, and you try not to jump other political boundaries, right?
That's right. That's not only the right thing to do, it's also the law. The law in the Constitution tells you have to be mindful of geographic and historic municipal boundaries. So it's the right thing to do. It's a bipartisan process. And just to be clear, they reached an agreement. Now, it was a little messy at the end, but they reached a bipartisan agreement, and our state Supreme Court, by no means even a middle-of-the-road court, approved it and said, yep, it was good. And then the legislature approved it with a strong bipartisan vote in 2022 after it was put in place. So we started with a bipartisan agreement, and the Democrats have used the federal court system and a group out of UCLA, the UCLA Voting Rights Project, which is, you know, funded from somewhere other than Washington State, let's put it that way, to try to undermine this whole thing. And looks, as of today, they've been enormously successful for Democrats.
Well, and I'll get to the decision today from the Ninth Circus Court. But before we get there, I just want to lay the groundwork. So when you've got this process and it's signed off on by two Democrats and two Republicans and then signed off on by a relative, a somewhat bipartisan legislature, and then signed off by, as you point out, as far as I'm concerned, Senator, I won't put these words in your mouth, a screaming left-wing Washington State Supreme Court says, yeah, you got a good result there. That's what we'll go with. How in the world does anybody get standing to say, we've taken this whole process, done it by the law, done it by the book, signed off on by everybody, including very liberal parts of state government, and then they go to the courts and say, now throw the federal courts and say, throw the whole thing out and let the judge rewrite it?
Yeah, the accomplishment, one is they're misusing the Voting Rights Act to get a political advantage, and then the way they litigate is they sue the state, and they rely on and the state, of course, relies on the Attorney General to defend it, and in this case, the Secretary of State is also a party, and both the Attorney General and the Secretary of State have not only refused to defend the lawsuit, which I believe was meritless, they've actually jumped on the plaintiff's side on the lawsuit in the case of the Attorney General. This is 100% a political play, using every member, you know, every Democrat political elected officer that they can, that will be helpful, to get the result they want. I mean, that's how they get through
now,
the court.
Now, hold on. Let's put one name in there, Bob Ferguson.
Absolutely.
Now, so that means the guy who wants to be governor is seeking to take a bipartisan process at the state level, signed off on by everybody, including very liberal parts of the state government, and then he says, well, I'm just not going to defend the process, the result we came up with. I'm going to let the thing be torn apart by a federal judge. And by the way, I'm running for governor, and I need my Democrat friends. So I want them to have a solid win out of this. That's what he's doing.
That is 100%. He hopes to be governor, and he wants to have as many Democrats in the legislature as he can get when he's governor, so he can 100% get his way, and he can ignore, essentially one half of the state that doesn't agree with him.
So how is it that if these liberal groups from out of state can tear apart Washington State's legislative map and have it rewritten by a judge, and then your side, our side, the right side goes in and says to the Ninth Circus Court, the crazy court in San Francisco, which is overturned more often than every other appeals court in America, and say, we want to contest this. And the Ninth Circuit Court says, sorry, you don't have standing. So only the left wingers have standing.
Well, no, what's happened is, since the state wouldn't defend, we have some interveners from over in the Yakima area that have got the approval from the courts to defend the lawsuit, and it is in appeal to the Ninth Circuit right now. What the Ninth Circuit has said no to is an emergency stay. So the local federal judge has issued new maps that do significant harm to the Republicans. I would say to the state and to balance in our state. So everybody's affected. Whether you live in the central Yakima Valley or not, this is affecting everybody at this point. And we've asked for a stay.
Don't have standing, right?
That's right. So we've appealed that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll see. And they're considering it right now. We expect a decision this week. Hopefully, they will see the ridiculousness of the maps that Judge Lasnik has put down. Maps that don't just, assuming there's a problem, which I fundamentally disagree with, but that's the judge's decision. Assuming there's a problem, he goes way out of his way. I mean, the Democrats have swung for the fences here, and he's given them everything they wanted, not just a move a district from plus two Republican to a plus eight Democrat. It's also given them a district in here in Southwest Washington, where I'm from, the 17th legislative district. It's made it more Democratic, and it went from a slightly Republican district to a slightly Democratic district. It's made one other district more competitive. It's districted out three sitting state senators, all Republicans, never affected a single Democrat. All Republicans moved out of the district, including the first Latina state senator,
Nikki Torres,
from the east side.
And she gets knocked out altogether because the Democrats got a federal judge to overturn a bipartisan plan from the state of Washington. Senator Braun, thanks so much. Back in a moment, we'll talk about whether Biden or Trump is the bigger threat to... the groundbreaking.
Exercising the right to free speech every day. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Biden is a much worse threat to democracy. And the reason for that is President Biden is the first candidate in history, the first president in history that has used the federal agencies to censor political speech. So to censor
that is
opponent.
That is the voice of RFK Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and yes, he's running for president of the United States, and he's likely going to do a lot of damage to the campaign of Joe Biden, because I don't think there are going to be as many conservatives who vote for RFK Jr. as there are liberals who vote for RFK Jr., and there's a little bit of a trap in there, but let me get into that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. I'm glad to have you with me. We call it the best conversation in talk journalism. It actually delivers on being honestly provocative talk radio. And I want to talk about this idea, because you hear Joe Biden and some of his fellow Democrats who are constantly saying Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. And a lot of us will point out, well, first of all, we're not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic. And there's a gigantic difference. But even if you wave that aside and say, okay, we are a country in which the people are able to vote for their representatives, members of the House, members of the Senate, President of the United States. And there's a little bit of a disconnect because the popular vote does not choose the president. Thank God. We have the Electoral College. And, you know, every election cycle, as we choose a new president, we end up having to explain, why is the Electoral College a good idea? And I can get into that if you like to. But I honestly think if you just allow the language to say, is Donald Trump a threat to democracy? Is Joe Biden a threat to democracy? And I like RFK Jr.'s argument. Now, I know that a lot of conservatives have recently said to me, they've sent emails and posted things and said, well, isn't this RFK guy great? On a couple of things, yes. On about two dozen other things, no. He's a complete train wreck when it comes to a lot of other issues. And in fact, I've got a list that I've made up of all the things that RFK really fails on. So don't be beguiled by the fact that he's right on a couple of things. He is dead wrong on so many things. But on this one, he's absolutely right. Joe Biden is the threat. And think about the fact that he's saying something you will likely never hear on the mainstream media. And that is, which president used federal agencies, including, believe it or not, the FBI, the DOJ, the CIA, the IRS? Which president used those federal agencies to censor his opponents? And we all know that Joe Biden and Barack Obama both use federal agencies to influence what you read and what I read and what we see on social media. I mean, to the point, the famous example or infamous example is the Hunter Biden laptop story, the one in which Americans were told Joe Biden and his family have been involved in dirty deals overseas that we now know, we can document, have made the Biden crime family about $30 million that we know of. Now, there may be a lot more, but at least $30 million. And what were they selling? Were they selling fentanyl or human trafficking? Well, Joe's in the human trafficking business now because of his border policies. But back in the day, what his son was selling was influence of Vice President Joe Biden, former Senator Joe Biden, and then presidential candidate Joe Biden. But most of it happened during his vice presidency. So what does RFK say about social media? Take a listen to this.
37 hours after he took the oath of office, he was censoring me. No president in the country has ever done that. The greatest threat the democracy is not somebody who questions election returns, but a president of the United States who used the power of his office to force the social media companies, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, to open a portal and give access to that portal to the FBI, to the CIA, to the IRS, to CISA, to NIH, to censor his political critics.
Now, imagine that. And he's absolutely right about that. He said that began 37 hours after he announced his candidacy, because the Biden crime family has decided it's going to hang on to power, even if what they have to do is take all of the tools that taxpayers have paid for and expect service from. Could we have a country without an intelligence agency like the CIA? I don't think you could maintain a country, certainly not a country like ours, without the ability to gain information about threats to this country. The problem is Democrats, and Joe Biden in particular, have used the CIA. They have perverted the CIA. And they've said, we're not just going to gather intelligence on threats to the United States to protect the country. We're going to use the CIA to do surveillance on our political opponents. And when necessary, when desirable, we're going to shut those political opponents down. He's used the FBI the same way. And he's practically declared war, not just on his political opponents like Donald Trump. He's declared war on any American conservatives. If you haven't noticed this, you may not be paying attention. But the DOJ has announced that if you're white, if you're an American citizen and you're a Christian, maybe you own guns, maybe you quote from the Bible, you are viewed as a potential domestic terrorist and you will be investigated. Now, I know that some of you are going to say, well, yeah, but that isn't actually happening. Well, tell that to the father of a 12-year-old boy who went to a pro-life rally. And at the pro-life rally, somebody was advancing on his 12-year-old boy and was screaming at this kid, and dad stepped in the way like any decent dad would do, and he pushed the person back. Didn't shove him to the ground, didn't beat him up, didn't do any of that. How did he end up with a dozen FBI agents in SWAT gear and automatic weapons standing on his front doorstep demanding his surrender and take him into custody for that? Why does it happen to those people and not to, say, the leaders of Antifa, which is a violent terrorist organization, BLM, which is largely a financial scam, but violent all the same? It doesn't happen to them because Joe Biden doesn't sic those federal agencies on them. So, and then take this into account. Even though RFK Jr. is not my choice as the candidate for president, the fact is, any major candidate for president should be afforded protection by the Secret Service. Listen to RFK Jr. on that.
President Biden, for the first president in history, used the secret, his power over the Secret Service, to deny Secret Service protection to one of his political opponents for political reasons. He's weaponizing the federal agencies. Those are really critical threats.
Now, I got to tell you something. I understand that RFK Jr.'s voice may be a little difficult to listen to. I feel for the guy. I can't imagine what would happen. I think the ailment he has is called spasmodic dysphonia. But in any case, even if I mangled that, fact is, this is something he didn't bring on himself. It is something that happens to people from time to time. But listen, instead of listening to what he, how he says it, listen to what he's saying. Is somebody like Joe Biden, who has used the government that is supposed to serve you and me as citizens and used it instead to weaponize it to silence his political opponents? That's the kind of thing that Americans used to see happening in foreign countries like Russia and China and Venezuela and Cuba. And they'd say, boy, those countries are terrible. The government is allowed to use government agencies, police agencies, military agencies, or intelligence agencies to actually go out and silence political opponents. Remember what the left-wing media said a few weeks ago when Alexei Navalny died in prison? And they said, oh, that's Russia. That's where you throw your political opponents in jail. Well, I would point out to you, don't be a hypocrite. Isn't that exactly what Joe Biden and Letitia James and Fannie Willis and Jack Smith are all trying to do to Donald Trump? Isn't their ultimate goal to throw the man in jail because he's an opponent of Joe Biden? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. The sound of freedom. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You might or might not have heard that yesterday, the top commander in what's called the Quds Force of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps for Lebanon and Syria was assassinated in an airstrike. Now, since he's allied with Iran and Iran is the biggest sponsor of terrorism on the planet, I'm not too disappointed that they took him out. But I wanted to find out what this means and where we're headed. Russell Berman is the Walter Haas Professor in Humanities at Stanford and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and co-chair of the Working Group on Islamism and the International Order. Professor Berman, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Lars. Always happy to speak with you.
So what should we make of the fact that Mohammed Reza Zahedi has been taken out?
We should make a lot. This is a big blow to the Iranian leadership in that region. Not only was Zahedi taken out, but so was his deputy and five other leading members of the Quds force. It's going to be hard for Iran to quickly replace that leadership. This is the leadership that manages the connection between Iran and Syria and Lebanon. That is the land bridge, so to speak, from Iran to the Mediterranean. In addition to this direct attack on the leadership cadre, another aspect that is important is simply the fact where this took place. This was in the consulate as part of the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus. I've seen shots that shows the embassy itself untouched, and right next to it, the Canadian embassy untouched, and right in between the consulate is taken out. The consulate, however, was serving as the headquarters for the military coordination between Iran and the region. So this is a big win for the Israelis. The question is, what will happen next? In one view, this is going to provoke the Iranians to counterattack with some kind of escalation, talk of hitting Israeli embassies somewhere. Alternatively, this could be an effort by the Israelis to prevent escalation by telling Iran that it had gone too far when it sent a drone over Eilat, the southern Israeli city, just earlier this week. So we will see what history brings.
So, and this was clearly Israel's taking credit for this one, or are they yet officially?
Israel does not take credit for things like this. It says it does not comment on reports in the foreign press, but I don't think there's any doubt that this was an Israeli attack.
Is the United States doing what it should be doing about Iran? Because we keep seeing Joe Biden seemingly bending over backwards for the mad mullahs of Tehran and taking every opportunity to put more money in their pockets, to relieve sanctions, to do all these things. And yet Iran is behind most of what's going on with the Houthi terrorists, with Hamas, and with Hezbollah and the groups that are in the northern part of Israel. Should the United States be doing something, and is it doing any of those things it should be?
Well, you're absolutely right. As I've said before, Iran is the root cause of these various conflicts. The Israel-Palestine issue won't be resolved until the Iran question is answered. It is the source of instability in the region. And as you well know, there's a debate in American foreign policy circles. The Obama-Biden line is to appease Iran by being nice to Iran, by giving Iran more resources, by giving it diplomatic flexibility. The Obama-Biden team believes that it will limit Iranian aggression. The other side, and represented most emphatically by former President Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo, was to put pressure on Iran to have a strong sanctions regime, which brought Iran to its financial needs until Biden came in and pretty much has refused to enforce the sanctions, thereby providing Iran with billions of dollars, which it immediately provides to Hamas, Hezbollah, and other proxy forces.
I'm talking to Professor Russell Berman from Stanford and also the Hoover Institution, where we had a week of great broadcasts a couple of weeks ago. But tell me this, Professor, is there any historic basis to believe that Joe Biden can be right about appeasement? Because it seems to me that appeasement has never worked out, and historically, in situations like this, and that a strong front has almost always worked out. And if it hasn't worked out fully, it's certainly better than the appeasement option. Is there any basis for Joe Biden to say this is the right way to go, other than the fact that his old boss, Barack Obama, believed in appeasement as well?
His old boss, Barack Obama, who was the only president since Woodrow Wilson who has decided to stay in Washington after his term ended. So he is really the puppet master in this, I believe. Listen, history is long. There may have been moments where appeasement worked, but in most cases in recent history, in the 20th century and 21st century, peace through strength, not peace through weakness. Biden and Lincoln believe that making premature concessions to the enemy will become nicer. I disagree. I think when we offer concessions, the enemy grows stronger and sees us as weak.
And does that work especially in an environment in which one of the major players is a Muslim player like Iran is? Is there a cultural difference between the Middle East and the way people and leaders in that region look at a strong leader and strong response versus, say, Western Europe or other folks on the planet?
Listen, as Israelis often say, they live in a tough neighborhood. I'm not quite sure it has to do with Islam as such, but it's a tough neighborhood where it is strength that gets respect, not weakness. I don't think appeasement would work toward China. I don't think appeasement worked toward Germany in the 1930s. But right now, for sure, the Biden administration has been throwing candy at Iran ever since it came into power, and it has not got anything in return. Dead Americans and dead Israelis.
Well, and Professor, about China, I mean, the idea in the 70s under Nixon and Kissinger was if we bring China into the community of nations, they'll start to behave. And none of that has worked, has it?
None of it has worked. I think if you roll back history to the 1970s, there was an argument for that Nixon to China move as a way to pull China away from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, which then suffered defeat in the Cold War. So that was an American win, and that probably was due in part to breaking up that Russia-China alliance. But in the meantime, China has just become a stronger adversary, and President Trump and Secretary Pompeo recognized that, and now we're faced with a different kind of adversary in the Western Pacific.
Do you suspect that even Obama, I've always suspected that he's sitting in his basement somewhere and that his former staffers surrounding Joe Biden are merely communicating his orders and Joe isn't really calling the shots. But no matter who's calling the shots, don't they see how none of this is working and they need to go another direction?
I think that a lot of that team has bought into the liberal left line that the problems of the world are largely due to the United States and to the West. This is the anti-imperialist line. And the only way, the right way, the just way forward is to throw support behind the revolutionaries of the Third World. I think this is the big divide between Democrats and Republicans. Of course, there are divides within each party, but in general, Democrats are comfortable with Iran and a revolutionary third worldist regime. Republicans are not. Republicans are more comfortable with a moderate monarchy like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, I may sound like a Neanderthal, but it sounds like Barack Obama never did get over his deadbeat dad and his deadbeat dad's views on colonialism. That's Russell Berman, professor at Stanford, also at the Hoover Institution. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Because you like what you hear, right? Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. I want to tell you about a comparison. I've been making a bit of a comparison between the Key Bridge in Baltimore that fell down when a large container ship hit it, and the Interstate Bridge replacement, which has been a boondoggle for literally decades in the Northwest. Hundreds of millions of dollars spent, a bridge that's never been replaced, as they planned to do with what was originally called the Columbia River Crossing. That one failed after about $200 million spent, and nothing got done. And now they have a new project that's almost as big a boondoggle. They have already spent millions on this one, and I don't think this one's going to happen either. And it is called the IBR, the Interstate Bridge Replacement. But we'll get to that in just a moment. First, the poll on X, and you'll find it at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Our question, should Americans pay the housing costs for asylum seekers? And the asylum seekers, by the way, are about 95% likely to be denied their asylum claim in the United States. And the I think this is Como. It might be the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper Seattle Times. No, this is Como News. And what's amazing to me, the headline on their story, asylum-seeking refugees forced to fundraise to extend their stay in a hotel in Kent, Washington. And I thought, well, of course they're going to have to raise some money. If you stay in a hotel, it costs money. And there are apparently people who believe that that cost should be paid by the taxpayers of Washington State. A group of 240 refugees on the brink of losing their housing in the city of Kent. Now, Seattle provided enough funding for 1 month for the very first request. Then they declined a second request. So you've got 240 people. Now, I understand these people are seeking asylum. I also understand that the federal courts in America are almost certain to turn almost all of them down. Maybe 5%, could be even 10% of them will actually get approval for asylum status in the United States. The rest will be told it's time for you to leave. You don't meet the criteria under the law. So should Americans pay the housing costs of these asylum seekers? Whether it's taxes in Seattle, taxes in Washington State, or federal taxes, I don't think the taxpayers should be on the hook. My answer would be no. You can answer any way you like. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Now, yesterday, I told you how the president of Mexico went on American TV on CBS 60 Minutes, and he literally said, we will not even talk about cooperating with the United States until the United States changes its policies on Venezuela, changes its policies on Cuba, and gives us $10 billion. Donald Trump's answer to that demand from Mexico was, they're not going to get 10 cents from me. Joe Biden apparently is still thinking about it. I said, should the U.S. buy Mexico's help on our southern border or make them pay another way? 93% of you joined me in a no vote and on that. I said no. Only 7% of you said yes to the idea, because we're supposed to pay Mexico, and they're in a position where they apparently believe that Joe Biden is such a weak-willed leader of the United States that they can sit there in Mexico and make demands. Say, we're not even going to talk about helping you till you give us a big pile of cash. Oh, and by the way, change some of your policies toward other countries. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540 Training. You got to check this out. It's 540training.com. 540 offers all kinds of training, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540 Training, all spelled out, 540training.com. Now, let me tell you about this comparison, because I think the comparison between what is going on in Baltimore right now, where the president has already said the U.S. taxpayers will pay the entire cost of replacing that bridge. And then Janet Yellen, his Treasury Secretary, had to come out and say, well, we're going to try to get the money out of the shipping company. If the shipping company's ship knocked that bridge down, the shipping company or the ship owner should pay the cost. But consider what my friend John Lee wrote at Clark County Today about comparing these two bridge projects, because the comparison is stunning. IBR, that's the one over the Columbia River, is less than half the length and one-third lower over the water than the one in Baltimore, but it is 20 times as expensive, or so we're told. Now, what have they said about Key Bridge in Baltimore? That they could get it replaced in anywhere from 18 months to 2 years. There are other people who say it may take a couple more years. What are they saying it will take for the interstate bridge replacement? They're saying a decade of construction to build a bridge that is 62 feet lower than the current structure still doesn't have Coast Guard approval. I don't think it's going to get Coast Guard approval because the Coast Guard is in charge of making sure that bridge is high enough to be able to clear the river traffic, and the one they're proposing does not. And then John Lee at Clark County Today makes this comparison. When the I-35 bridge about 15 years ago in Minneapolis fell down because it was designed wrong, it was 8 lanes each way. The interstate bridge is only 3 lanes each way. They replaced it with a 10-lane bridge that they finished in 13 months for $234 million. That would be about $350 million in today's dollars. What are they telling us the interstate bridge replacement will be? $7.5 billion. Now, if that makes sense to anybody, I'd love to hear the naysayer call. Back in a moment. It's a Tuesday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I know there are times when I've actually insulted drunken sailors by saying that so-and-so spends like drunken sailors, so maybe these days we need to modify that and say why that person or that agency is spending like a progressive squad member. And to explain that, I've invited our friend Adam Andrzejewski on. He's the CEO and founder of Open the Books. He looks at the numbers that come out of government, and then he tells us how they actually add up. And some of that spending record has to do with the America-hating squad members, you know, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the brains of the outfit. Adam, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be on the program, Lars. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, I'm glad to do it, but and I want people to go to openthebooks.com because, you know, they shouldn't just take my word for it. They should look at the numbers themselves because it's an eye-opener. And frankly, you take all these tomes of reams of information that governments shovel out, and then you put it into some kind of understandable format while still allowing people access to the original source documents so they can see, oh, that's actually where, because ordinarily I've seen city budgets before and county and state, federal, they are almost unreadable. There's no way to understand what's in them, which kind of belies the point of having a budget, doesn't it?
Yeah, big time. Last year, Lars, we filed 55,000 Freedom of Information Act requests. It was the most in American history, and we captured nearly every dime taxed and spent at every level of government across the entire country for the first time in American history. And
wow.
You can search it all on our website for free.
Yeah, it's amazing, and I'm glad for your sponsors, the folks who actually put the money up behind this. But tell me this, what do we know about the squad and how they like to spend the taxpayers' money?
Yeah, seriously. So we found that they, in the last 2 years, just in the last 2 years, 2023 and 2024, first the 6 members of the squad in 2023, and their numbers are growing, Lars. They're now at 8 members.
Of course.
They collectively earmark nearly
$250 million. Metastasizing, Adam. I think metastasizing is a better terminology when talking about the squad, but go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, they earmarked nearly $250 million. It's $224 million just since 2003 on these omnibus spending bills. They're led by AOC, and it's pork barrel spending by the Democratic Socialists.
So what is this money getting spent on? What kind of thing?
Well, it's spent on the squad goals, of course. So, for instance, you've got $1.7 million to help the environmental leaders of color build a quote-unquote green tech park. The group's goal is to assist the marginalized communities in preparing for climate change adverse effects so they can thrive like healthy plants in their natural ecosystems. And that patron was Jamal Bowman out of New York.
Now, they're doing this and they're making it race specific. Is that right?
Yeah, they are. So there's 850,000.
I thought green was just green.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, the Green New Deal that they can't get passed. That's AOC's baby. So they break it up into earmarks, and we can go through some of those. But let's go through some of the race-based earmarking. You got nearly $1 million to create jobs for the black community near the George Floyd Square, obviously, who's deaf in 2020. It was a no-go zone for police around that square. It's a symbol of the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, they wanted to defund the police, so problems in that regard are largely of their own making. Obviously, that's been discredited, that movement. And so they want to create jobs in that area, and I guess they're leaning on all of us to fund it. And that patron was Congresswoman Ilhan Omar.
Now, what else have they spent on?
One, you know, so they don't like ICE, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Yep.
Right, to defend the border. But, for instance, AOC put, and a colleague of hers, put $1.35 million into NICE. Not ICE, but NICE, the New Immigrant Community Empowerment Organization. Now, this is a nonprofit that advocates for citizens for all illegal aliens.
All illegal aliens?
That's their position. And, you know, you've got, you know, folks that should know better. So you've got Greg Cesar. He's down in Austin, Texas, in the San Antonio area of Texas. Hardly no member of Congress is as close to the, you know, the border problems as Greg Cesar. And he earmarks $1 million for the San Antonio College Empowerment Center, which runs an undocumented student support program to help illegal entrants enroll in the school. And so, you know, they're creating a magnet. They're creating a magnet for illegal entrants, you know, and so we'll get more of them.
I mean, because in some cases, we're doing things that are so aimed at simply drawing more people in. As you point out, if a young man or woman said, well, you know, I've finished some schooling in one country, but I really can't afford to go to college or anything like that. But America has great community colleges. Why don't I just go to the border, walk across, and I'll be able to go to a community college, and they'll help me do it. I mean, talk about a draw for young people. And this is assuming these aren't the drug traffickers, human traffickers, potential terrorists, convicted criminals, and all those people. But there are others in that crowd. And we're literally just saying we're going to do everything we can, as the Democrats are, to draw these people into the United States.
Or they're using their earmarks to divide us. Again, race-based earmarks. $1.5 million to build specialty grocery stores and education facilities for black farmers in the St. Louis, Missouri area. And that patron was Congresswoman Cori Bush.
Now, hold on. So black farmers to sell their goods or for black customers to buy the goods?
Well, it's unclear, but it looks like for black farmers to sell their goods in these specialty grocery stores and to educate them on how to become, you know, how to, you know, black farmers how to farm better.
Yeah, but how do you teach people to do something better by subsidizing that activity? Why don't the black farmers just sell products the way any farmer of any racial background sells products? Sell them to the marketplace.
Right.
And I don't think, if you're a farmer, I assume you don't care what color the people are who buy your products, as long as they buy your products, as long as your money is green.
And some of these earmarks, you know, it's counterproductive in terms of help people who have real needs. For instance, people that don't have a home, that are in homeless shelters, there's $500,000. Again, patron Cori Bush out of the St. Louis area. It's into a St. Louis homeless shelter to improve the energy efficiency of the shelter. They're heating, you know, so like a Green New Deal earmark into a homeless shelter, but it does nothing to improve the care for the homeless.
Unbelievable. Last thing, though, I'll be fair about this. Republicans have gone along with this. Is that right?
Well, Republicans opened the door for all this craziness, this quote-unquote free-for-all. Because, Lars, as you know, every dime of these earmarks is borrowed. Republican and Democrat earmarks is borrowed against the national debt. And so in secret votes, each of the last 3 years, the Republican House Caucus voted to join the Democrats to keep earmarking. And so, look, at OpenTheBooks.com, we have a petition. We're calling for an up or down vote in the House on this election year. We deserve to be able to see who's in who's out on earmark is critical during this election cycle.
Absolutely right. That's Adam Andrzejewski, the CEO and founder of OpenTheBooks.com. I highly recommend it. Back in a moment, we'll talk about Donald Trump's gag order.
Simply by listening, you're proving how smart you really are. Lars thanks you.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Does President Donald Trump have a right to complain publicly about a judge's daughter who makes a huge amount of money in politics? Well, my answer to that would be yes, but let me explain why I'm even asking the question. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our poll on X. The X poll replaced the Twitter poll, and you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. You know, this one seems like such an easy call, and I would think the public would be mad about this, but imagine this. If you or a member of your family were accused of a crime, and let's say for the sake of argument, it was a crime that you didn't commit, you weren't guilty, and then you found out that the judge who is going to be running the trial where you are on trial had a daughter or a son who was in a business that conflicted with what you do. And you say, well, does that give the judge, you know, forgive the saying, but it's the way I describe it, a dog in the fight? Well, this judge has now put a gag order on Donald Trump. And when did that gag order come? After Trump mentioned Judge Juan Merchan's daughter. Now, it's the name of the judge who's hearing this case, because Donald Trump put this on Truth Social. There were posts in which, well, here's the way you'll see it described in the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, the newspaper, or on television or on radio. Donald Trump attacked Merchan's daughter on Truth Social. The new order prohibits Trump from mentioning family members of the court and the prosecutors. Now, you might think, well, Donald Trump attacked some young lady. What in the world did she do to him? Well, let me tell you what Judge Merchan's daughter does for a living, because that's significant. The judge's daughter runs a company, and she is the president of that company. And the company is called Authentic Campaigns. It is located in Chicago, Illinois. And what do? They run political campaigns, but not for Republicans. They run political campaigns for the likes of Adam Schiff, Democrat from California. So how does that affect the judge? Well, clearly the judge doesn't like it when Donald Trump mentions his daughter. But do you think that Donald Trump has any reason to fear that the judge is going to be biased against Trump and biased in favor of the case against him simply because the judge's daughter runs a political campaign company? And in fact, she has helped Democrats raise about $93 million. $93 million raised with the help of this young lady, Lauren Merchan, who is president of Authentic Campaigns. And in fact, the Chicago-based political consulting firm, whose top clients include Adam Schiff, who was the lead prosecutor in Trump's first impeachment trial, and the Senate Majority PAC, a majority party fundraiser. And here's what Trump said. Authentic Campaigns, and thus the judge's daughter, is actively making money from this sham attack against President Trump. Because get this, the daughter is not just running campaigns, she's raising money. But part of the way she's raising money is saying, look, Donald Trump is on trial. Now, this is the so-called hush money trial. I don't even accept the description of hush money. What hush money is it is non-disclosure agreements, NDAs. Now, you say, well, aren't NDAs kind of unusual? They're not unusual at all. In fact, almost everybody who works for a media organization has had to sign an NDA when they're leaving one television network or radio network or employer in the media. And why did they sign NDAs? Because you become privy to information that could be tremendously valuable if you were able to take that information to a new employer. In the case of Trump, Trump is said to have paid hush money to Stormy Daniels, the porn actress who claims that she had a one-night stand, although she has recanted that story. And Donald Trump has always said the one-night stand never happened, but money was paid. So now he's on trial. And who's put him on trial? Well, that would be Alvin Bragg, a Democrat DA in New York City. What's the crime? The crime is allegedly falsification of business records. And New York does enforce this law. But let me tell you a couple of complicating factors, and it does get a little bit complicated. Is it legal to falsify business records in New York City? No, it is against the law. Is that prosecuted in New York City? It is from time to time. When is it usually prosecuted? When somebody falsifies a business record in a way that puts money in his pocket. Well, did that happen in the Donald Trump case? No, it didn't. Is there a statute of limitations on the falsification of business records law? Yes, there is. It's 2 years. Has the statute of limitations already run out? Yes, it has. So what is Alvin Bragg actually prosecuting? He's prosecuting a federal elections claim. Well, hold on a second, Lars. Are local DAs allowed to prosecute federal election crimes? No, they're not. But the federal election crime has a longer statute of limitations. So Alvin Bragg, a local DA in New York State, is trying to prosecute a federal crime that he has no authority to prosecute. Well, did anybody else have a chance to bring federal election charges against Donald Trump? Yep. The Federal Elections Commission could have done it. The Attorney General, Merrick Garland, could have done it. The Department of Justice could have done it. Well, did they do it? No, they didn't. So Donald Trump is being prosecuted for falsifying business records in a state in which the charge, the crime, has to be prosecuted within 2 years of when it happened, and the statute of limitations already run out. Instead, the local DA is using a federal law that he has no authority to use. Does this sound like a highly political case to you? Yep. And now we find out the judge's daughter is involved in politics. She runs a company that raises tens of millions of dollars, but only for Democrats. And is her work as a campaign fundraiser for Democrats going to affect the judge's point of view? I think it does. Does the judge appreciate Donald Trump taking issue with the way his daughter makes money? He does not. So now the judge has put a gag order on Donald Trump and said, you can't talk about my daughter anymore. You can't point out that Judge Juan Merchan has a conflict of interest. And should the judge step aside and recuse himself from the case? He should. Is he going to? No, he's not. And why? Well, because if the judge runs a trial in which Donald Trump is found guilty of a crime, a federal crime, prosecuted by a local DA who has no authority to prosecute that crime, instead of the crime of New York State, which he does have a right to prosecute, but the statute of limitations has already run out. Again, this is one of those cases where the Democrats have decided we will prosecute Donald Trump for something. We don't care if the statute of limitations has run out. We don't care if nobody put any money in their pocket because business records are falsified. And there's even an argument to be made that no business records were falsified. Donald Trump paid his attorney. The attorney paid off Stormy Daniels. Stormy Daniels kept her mouth shut and later recanted her story about the one-night affair. And Donald Trump has always said it never happened at all. Glad to have you with me and glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Just think of him as your concealed carry.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And when I read a really great piece, I've got to get the author on to talk to him about it. And that is John Daniel Davidson, who's a senior editor of The Federalist and the author of a brand new book called Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. Now, John Daniel Davidson, welcome to the program. And I got to tell you, my audience already heard my diatribes yesterday on the fact that the White House, and Friday, on the fact that the White House, I guess, coincidentally decided to drop the bomb of the Trans Day of Visibility right on top of Easter. But it was a complete coincidence, right?
Oh, yeah, right. And if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you. No, this was totally meant to be a thumb in the eye of Christians all over the country. It was done on purpose. There's no way it could have been an accident. And we know that not just because of the White House's statement, but the subsequent statements from the Department of State and Department of Interior and Vice President Kamala Harris's statements. It was a whole coordinated effort by the Biden administration to make Easter Sunday not about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the holiest day on the Christian calendar, but about transgender ideology, a fundamentally, pagan religious observation that has nothing to do with the dominant Christian culture in America, or I should say the once dominant Christian culture.
Now, I don't want to overstate what you said, and I do want people to read your book, John Daniel, but is it fair to say that this isn't about merely wanting to be visible or get your cause out there? This is about the hatred that's starting to develop on one side of the political aisle, it seems almost exclusively, against Christian Americans.
Yes, it is. And it's about really undermining the kind of society that Christian civilization makes possible. And what I mean by that is the kind of society in which we have universal moral precepts that apply to everybody, which means everybody has individual rights. Everybody is allowed to have freedom of speech and freedom of religion. Everybody is, has to give their consent to the government. Everybody gets to vote and have a say in how they're ruled, right? That's the inheritance of Christianity. It's we take it for granted now as sort of like secular liberalism, but it's not really secular. It's the product of a Christian civilization. And when you take Christianity away and you reject Christianity, you have to reject those principles eventually, and you replace them with something else. And what you replace them with, and what we're now seeing, is you replace them with a fundamentally pagan worldview in which force and power determine what is right and determine who rules and who has to obey. And that's what we're seeing, this extreme intolerance of other people's views, this extreme intolerance of Christianity. That's the fruits of a post-Christian ethos, a fundamentally pagan worldview.
His book is called Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. So not exactly an optimistic title, but John Daniel, this is one of the things I've tried on people, because they'll say, well, Lars, America is not a Christian nation. I say, no, it's not, because we're not a theocracy, but we were founded by Christians, and we have Christian principles that say you can choose for whatever faith you want or no faith at all. And by the way, we do get calls from atheists and people of other faiths, and that's okay. But if we lived in, say, a Muslim country, a majority Muslim country with Sharia law, there'd be no religious liberty at all, would we?
No.
Would we have it?
No. Yeah, you're exactly right. No, it's only Christian societies that have this idea of religious liberty or freedom of conscience or freedom of speech. Those things are luxuries that only Christian societies can afford, because those things are come out of Christian principles and Christian doctrines about the nature of man and the nature of God. And you don't have them. If you reject Christianity, you eventually will reject those moral precepts. And what comes in its place is a pagan moral precept that says there is no such thing as objective moral truth. There is no such thing as transcendent reality. There is only will and force. And there's nothing to stop those with power from exploiting those who don't have power. There's no protection for the weak, for the minority. Those things are only possible with the principles and the values that derive from Christianity. And when you say that we're not founded as a Christian nation, that's right in the sense that we weren't founded as a theocracy, but the founders were very clear that the kind of Republican self-government that they had in mind was only going to be possible with a Christian people. A non-sectarian, in other words, no state church, no federally backed church, but self-government within a Christian society that's able to tolerate religious minorities. That was always the vision, and we've lost it.
I'm talking to John Daniel Davidson, who's got a new book, but he also writes at The Federalist. But there were a couple of the early colonies that turned into states that wanted, or they actually talked about saying, let's make this, you know, a Christian only state. And that was rejected by the people of the new United States, right?
Well, the first Congress said that, you know, when they passed the First Amendment, they said there would be no establishment of religion. In other words, Congress, the federal government, wouldn't tax people to support a national church. Right? They were trying to get away from the religious wars of Europe. But many states at the time of the founding, at the time of the ratification of the First Amendment, still had establishments. They still had state-established churches, and some of those establishments persisted for a long time. Now, you're right. Eventually, the people themselves chose to get rid of those establishments. But the founders didn't see that at the state level as a contradiction of the First Amendment. In fact, the first Congress appropriated taxpayer money for a chaplain, a congressional chaplain, before the First Amendment was ratified. So you would think if they thought that counted as an establishment of religion, they wouldn't have done it. They had a very different idea of what establishment of religion means than we do today, and a much more capacious idea of the role of religion, the Christian religion, in informing the public square and informing public policy.
Now,
we've
John Daniel,
very far away from that.
John Daniel, I've told my audience, I always admit if I have a bias on some subject, whatever it is, I'll just disclose it because I'd rather disclosure, unlike the way the Supreme Court has been acting recently, but that's subject for another day. But there was just a controversy over the fact that one of the chaplains invited to come in and give the invocation one day actually mentioned Jesus Christ, and apparently he found out that was against the rules. So people are beginning to push on Christianity in particular recently. Why is that happening? And am I right in suspecting it may be happening because as the country slides towards socialism or communism, religion is usually virtually forbidden, if not outright forbidden, in all communist countries?
Well, I would argue that we're not sliding towards an atheistic communism. The future of America is not sort of secular liberalism, you know, that is atheistic and libertarian and kind of like has a live and let live. You do what's right for you, I'll do what's right for me. The future of America is more pagan. And by pagan, I mean there will be an official state religion that everyone has to agree to. And we see that emerging, especially on the trans movement and LGBT issues. If you don't affirm those things, if you question them, the state is going to come after you. And if you don't believe me, ask Jack Phillips, the Colorado baker, who's been a decade in litigation because he didn't want to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple because of his religious views. There's a deep intolerance here. There's a deep intolerance, and it's not an atheistic. It doesn't come from atheistic beliefs. It comes from a new form of paganism that says, you know, what I believe, my faith claim, trumps yours, and I'm not going to tolerate yours.
Unbelievable. The book is called Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. Its author is John Daniel Davidson, who also writes on a regular basis as a senior editor of The Federalist. John Daniel, it's a pleasure to have you on. You're welcome back anytime.
I'd love that. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. Back in a moment. I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. Check out our Instagram feed, Facebook, and all that good stuff. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Guys, for those...
Saying the things you wish you could say. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. Call 541-ONA-GEN. That's 541-ONA-GEN. And our X poll today. Should Americans pay the housing costs for asylum seekers? 240 refugees are in a hotel in the city of Kent. The city of Seattle paid for a month for them to stay there. They say they need somebody else to pay for their hotel rooms now because they're seeking asylum in America. As you, if you know the numbers on asylum seekers, 90 to 95% of them are ultimately rejected, although who knows under the Biden administration whether or not that's going to happen. But they're not saying, hey, somebody's got to pay our bills for us. How about you Americans? In the meantime, they're trying to raise the money to stay at the hotel, the Quality Inn in Kent. And they've already been there for a period of time with their expenses paid by the people of Seattle. Should Americans be paying the housing costs for asylum seekers? I'd say no to that. You can answer the question any way you like. You'll find it on X at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, our website. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to David. David, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, I just had a comment about listening yesterday about people that were saying that God let everybody do whatever they wanted to do.
Who said that? And,
well, that was, I don't remember. There was talking with some lady yesterday about how they, Jesus accepted everybody and they could do whatever they wanted to do.
I see what you're saying. She said, no, well, but he also made it clear what he thought was wrong and what was right. And that, I think that's what John Daniel Davidson was saying, is that you now have people who live in a country that has the kind of rights and freedoms that we have because they're God-given rights, and they say, yeah, but we don't want the God part of it anymore. We just want to have another kind of religion where anything goes if it feels good. And so you've got people saying transgender, sexual mutilation of children, everything goes as long as we say it goes. And it's a kind of religion. But the woman yesterday was saying that she goes to a church that is accepting of all. And I said, well, what about people who are doing things that are wrong? And how do you decide what's wrong? And I mean, we've had this discussion for a long time of, well, how do you decide what's right or wrong if you don't have something that lays down a groundwork for believing that there are some things that are right and some things that are wrong? Adultery is wrong. Stealing is wrong. Killing is wrong. And you say, well, people will just naturally come up with their own ideas of what's right and wrong. No, that's a free-for-all. At least that's the way I view it.
Yes. And I mean, what happened with Sodom and Gomorrah?
They were cities that were destroyed because they were full of really perverse behavior, unfortunately. David, I appreciate the call. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And, you know, boy, the emails I get from people. I was looking for one in particular that came in earlier today. Lars, I listen when I can. This is Amber. I have a busy life running a business, a small ranch, and raising kids. Now, I didn't vote for the fool in the White House, and I plan on voting for Trump again this time. Most of the time, I agree with you, but on this Biden transgender issue, I disagree. This is not the most important issue to talk about this week. There are 100 different more important issues that really matter, but if this is the issue you want to charge up the hill and die for, well, I don't charge up any hills, and I don't die for any of these things, but I talk about them. But this election is not going to be won by the base Republicans or Democrats. It's going to be won by independents and libertarians. So by all means, feel free to fall into the Democrat trap of getting all upset about Biden saying and proclaiming that he sees trans people on Easter. Well, fact is, when Joe Biden was asked at the White House during that Easter event at the White House, they said, well, you signed this proclamation about Trans Visibility Day. Joe Biden actually denied it. He said, I didn't do that. I don't know anything about that. So, you know, just, I guess, one more piece of evidence that Joe Biden doesn't have any idea what's going on inside his own White House. There is a proclamation with his name on it that was posted online, and Joe Biden denies all knowledge of it. But In any case, she said, as I said, this election is going to be run by the independents, maybe a few Democrats who can't afford to put gas in their cars, and maybe they're thinking about voting for Trump, but then you come out and say this is horrific. This is the greatest sin imaginable on Easter. And the independent voter is going, wow, maybe it is true. The Republicans hate trans people. I don't hate anybody. You hate the sin, but not the sinner. I didn't hate my dad. I loved my dad, but he was an alcoholic. His behavior was wrong. You don't hate people. You hate what they do. And so she seems to think, I'm glad to share her email, but I think that she's wrong. If she's saying you've got to give up your beliefs, you've got to give up objecting to things that you think are wrong and damaging, absolutely damaging to people, including children. Do I think it's one of the most important issues in the world, whether or not society embraces the idea of mutilating children so they can meet some adult's idea of what is right? That's transgender. I mean, if an adult wants to wear different clothes, go ahead. Call yourself by a different name. Just keep your hands off the kids and stop mutilating teenage boys and girls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.